The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing a deep dive into, well, the world of classics.
Right. And when you hear classics, maybe you picture, I don't know, dusty statues.
Yeah.
Old Latin books.
Exactly. Or maybe a stuffy professor somewhere. But the book we're tackling, Classics, a very short introduction by Mary Beard and John Henderson, it just blows that whole image apart.
Yeah. That common idea that classics is dead or irrelevant, maybe even sort of elitist. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the stereotype they want to smash. Mm-hmm. If you think the ancient world, you know, Greece and Rome, has zero to say about our lives now.
Mm.
Well, this book argues you should think again.
It really does. Their core argument is pretty radical, actually. They say classics isn't some relic locked away in a museum.
No,
it's a living, breathing force. It's actively shaping our politics, our laws, our art, our culture, like right now.
Okay, let's unpack this. And that's our mission for this deep dive, isn't it? To understand why digging into ancient Greece and Rome isn't just about, you know, memorizing emperors or battles.
Right.
It's really about getting essential tools for thinking critically, for understanding power, identity, democracy, stuff that's vital in the 21st century.
So who are our guides on this? Well, we've got two heavyweights, Mary Beard and John Henderson. Both are distinguished professors at Cambridge.
It's a really interesting pairing. You have Mary Beard, who's become, I mean, almost the public face of the ancient world today.
She's everywhere.
And she's brilliant at making it accessible, right? Mm-hmm. Think of her book, SPQR. She brings that social history alive, ordinary people, women, the enslaved, makes it feel immediate.
He definitely makes it feel less intimidating, like something you can actually connect with. And then there's John Henderson.
Right. Henderson brings this deep critical edge. He's known for challenging the standard interpretations, really focusing on the tricky bits, the ambiguities in the language, the texts themselves, philology, basically.
So one makes it accessible, the other makes you question everything.
Kind of, yeah. And together, their perspective makes this book feel like, well, like a manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
They're arguing that classics shouldn't be some elite club.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a democratic tool. A way for anyone to think critically about the world by looking at the past. They're redefining why we even study it.
So it's less a history lesson, more like a guide to critical thinking using history.
That's a great way to put it. That's the central idea. The book argues classics is this ongoing conversation, sometimes a real argument, between the ancient world and us now.
Okay.
They're not so focused on finding the one true story of the past. They're more interested in the process, how we've engaged with it over centuries.
And they use this key term for that process, reception. So the value isn't finding out exactly what Julius Caesar had for breakfast.
Probably not, no.
But rather understanding how people later on, like Shakespeare or, I don't know, the founding fathers, or even us today, how we've used and reinterpreted those ancient ideas.
Precisely. That's the core of reception. The meaning of Rome or Athens isn't fixed. It changes depending on who's looking and when and why.
Okay.
And what's really refreshing is that this book doesn't give you that sanitized, heroic story of Western civilization.
Right. No golden age narrative.
No. It dives right into the messy stuff. Slavery, brutality, inequality, cultural clashes, which ironically makes the ancient world feel much more relevant to our own struggles, doesn't it?
It really does. So the book's goal ultimately is to help you, the listener, spot how classical ideas are already working in your life, in politics, maybe without you even noticing.
Exactly. And to do that, we need to look at the actual evidence we have, which is way more complicated and fragmented than you might think.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Let's talk about the classical canon. You know, Homer, Virgil, Plato, the usual suspects.
Some big names.
Yeah. Most of us assume they're in the canon because, well, they were geniuses, right? Objective greatness.
That's the common story.
But Beard and Henderson say, hold on, they call the canon a survival of the fittest story. And fitness here isn't about genius alone. It's about historical accident, pure luck, and ideology.
Well, right. Think about all the filters. What texts did medieval monks happen to copy? What did Renaissance scholars decide was important?
What did empires choose to teach in schools to, you know, justify their own power?
Exactly. All those choices shaped what survived to become classics. It wasn't some neutral process.
And the example they use that just hits you is Sappho, the poet.
Oh, yeah. Powerful.
We only have fragments, right? Tiny scraps found on papyrus, painstakingly pieced together. And it forces you to ask, what else is gone forever? Whose voices are missing? The classics we have today is just this tiny, highly selected slice of a much bigger, richer past. It's sobering, really.
It is. And that problem of incompleteness, of interpretation, extends right into the language itself. They talk about the problem of words.
Translation is tricky.
More than tricky. They argue every translation is an act of interpretation. It's not just swapping words, it's importing meaning.
Okay, give me an example.
Okay, think of the opening of Virgil's Aeneid, Arma virumque cano, arms and the man I sing.
Famous line.
Very. Now imagine a translator in Victorian England. They might really emphasize Aeneas' duty, his piety, the grandeur of founding an empire. It reflects their own imperial values, you know?
Right, projecting their own world onto the text.
But a modern translator, maybe they focus more on the trauma of war, the psychological cost for Aeneas, the loss and suffering.
Same Latin words, totally different feel.
Exactly. The text hasn't changed, but its meaning is shaped by the translator's world. So it raises that big question. Can we ever really get back to the original meaning, untouched by our own perspectives?
That's a tough one. Okay, so if words are slippery, what about physical objects? Let's talk things and archaeology.
Right. And here, too, the point isn't just look at this old pot. It's about the meaning these objects take on once they're rediscovered, the politics of artifacts.
Politics? How so?
We'll take the Locoon statue group, this incredibly dramatic sculpture. When it was dug up in a Roman vineyard in 1506, it wasn't just found. Its discovery immediately sparked huge debates and theories about art, suffering, the human form. It massively influenced Renaissance artists like Michelangelo. Its meaning was basically created in that moment of reception.
Wow. Okay. And I guess the ultimate example of this kind of political meaning is the Parthenon marbles.
Absolutely. The so-called Elgin marbles. They aren't just ancient sculptures anymore, are they?
No, they're symbols.
Huge symbols, caught up in massive debates about national identity, cultural heritage, who owns the past, the legacy of empire.
Yeah, whether they should be in London or Athens, that's a fierce debate today.
Precisely. It shows how the past is constantly being used, even weaponized in present-day arguments.
Okay, so artifacts aren't neutral either. This connects to the biggest stories, the grand narratives, right? Like the rise and fall of Rome.
Exactly. They use the example of Edward Gibbon's massive work, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Hugely influential book from the 18th century.
I've heard of it. Massive.
It is. But Beard and Henderson point out, Gibbon wasn't just writing history. He was also writing a warning, specifically to the British Empire of his own time.
Ah, so learn from Rome's mistakes or you'll fall too.
Pretty much. And that's the thing with these big sweeping narratives. They always simplify things, don't they? They offer easy lessons, usually moral ones, about why empires collapse or succeed.
Yeah, you see people doing that all the time, comparing modern nations to Rome.
And we need to be really skeptical about that. Anyone using Rome to justify some modern political agenda, well, you have to question it.
So the takeaway from all this, the canon, the words, the things, the big stories, is that the past is never just sitting there neutrally.
Never. It's always being interpreted, argued over, and put to work in the present. Always.
Okay, so if we boil this down, what are the main messages we should take away from the book?
I think the first big theme is seeing classics as a dynamic dialogue. It's not something you just passively receive. It's an active negotiation, a conversation across centuries.
Right. So the reflection there is history isn't just something you learn about. It's an argument you can actually join. It belongs to anyone who engages with it, basically.
Exactly. Then the second key theme is power and its critics. Ancient thinkers, especially the Romans like Tacitus, were incredibly sharp analysts of power.
How so?
They wrote these really cutting critiques of emperors, of corruption, the psychology of tyranny, how institutions decay.
That sounds depressingly relevant.
Doesn't it? And that's the point. We can use that ancient framework to look critically at power today. Executive overreach, political manipulation, the weaknesses in our own systems, it gives us a lens.
A historical perspective on current events.
Okay.
What's the third theme?
The third one is about the democratic potential of education. And this flips the whole elitist idea on its head. Well, if classics is taught right, focusing on this critical dialogue, on questioning assumptions, it becomes a tool for everyone. It helps you gain critical distance on your own culture.
By showing you societies that work completely differently, with totally different values.
Precisely. When you grapple with how ancient Greeks thought about gender or citizenship or slavery, things often radically different from our views, It forces you to examine your own taken-for-granted beliefs.
And that self-awareness, that ability to question your own cultural programming, is crucial for being an engaged citizen in a democracy, isn't it?
Absolutely essential.
The book also has some really punchy lines, doesn't it? Things that really stick with you.
Oh, definitely. They have a knack for summing up complex ideas very powerfully.
What's one that stands out?
How about, classics is not about the past. It is about the present and the future.
Okay, yeah. That nails the core idea, doesn't it? Its value is its usefulness now as a tool for understanding today and tomorrow. Here's another one I liked. Democracy was invented in ancient Athens, but so was the critique of democracy.
Ooh, that's a good one, too. It reminds us that ancient sources aren't just simple models to copy.
Right. They show the potential, but also the dangers. Demagoguery, mob rule, manipulation. The critiques were there from the start.
Gives you nuance, not just nostalgia. Maybe one more, which captures the sort of self-critical honesty of the book.
Okay.
Classical education has been both a tool of oppression and a weapon of liberation.
Wow. That acknowledges the problematic history, the elitism.
Right. But it also insists that the outcome depends entirely on how it's taught and how it's used. It puts the responsibility on us. It demands critical teaching, critical engagement.
This all sounds fascinating, but how do we actually apply this? Like, tomorrow, what are some real-life applications?
Okay, well, one immediate thing is media literacy. Political rhetoric. Next time you're listening to a political speech or seeing campaign ads, think about the analysis of ancient rhetoric and demagoguery in the book. Are they appealing to reason? Or are they using those age-old tactics? Fear, nostalgia, us versus them, oversimplification.
So use history to decode modern political language.
Yes. It helps you make more informed judgments. Another one is looking at architecture and cultural symbols.
You mean like those big buildings with columns?
Exactly. That neoclassical style courthouses, banks, universities, government buildings. When you see one, don't just think, oh, that looks old-fashioned.
Think about the message.
Right. Recognize it as a deliberate statement. It's consciously trying to invoke the authority, the stability, the perceived ideals of ancient Rome or Greece to lend legitimacy and power to that modern institution.
That's interesting. I'll look at those buildings differently now. Any other applications?
I think the most powerful one might be personal. Critical self-reflection. When you genuinely engage with the radically different values and assumptions of the ancient world about family or duty or sexuality or what makes a good life, it can jolt you.
Jolt you how?
It forces you to see your own culture's norms not as natural or obvious, but as just one way of organizing things. It helps you question your own deeply ingrained assumptions.
So it provides that critical distance we talked about, but on a personal level, fosters self-awareness.
Exactly. Which is maybe the most valuable thing of all.
Thinking back on all this, what was the most surprising thing for you or the biggest insight?
For me, I think it was really grasping how much interpretation, how much detective work goes into constructing our picture of the ancient world from such incredibly fragmentary evidence.
Yeah, the Sappho thing really brought that home.
It did. It makes the whole field seem less like settled fact and more like this exciting ongoing process of reconstruction and argument. And the lasting insight is just how permeable that boundary is between past and present. They're constantly influencing each other.
Yeah, that's really well put. And for me, I think the biggest takeaway is how this book turns classics from something that might seem, you know, kind of dry or academic.
Or intimidating.
Yeah. Into this really radical act of questioning. It makes it essential for anyone who wants to be an engaged citizen. It's not just about knowing facts. It's about learning how to ask better questions.
Mm-hmm.
Questions about power, about culture, about ourselves. That critical questioning mind that feels like the greatest value here.
Absolutely. It's fundamentally about cultivating curiosity, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.